So many thoughts about money coming up in this conversation with Tracy Twyman. I almost don't know where to begin, but let's go back to the beginning and just reaffirm why the title Solomon's Treasure before we go to the phones, and many people are hanging on already. But you say this goes all the way back to Solomon. Explain that connection.
Okay, well, I would like to, but I would also like to talk about some other stuff about the Templars that I forgot to mention previously that is kind of important to understanding why they're central to this argument here. It's important to realize that the Knights Templar were responsible for basically inventing the banking system, that there wasn't banking as such before they came up with this idea. They were, we talked previously about how Europe used to be it had a feudalist economy. It's coming out of the Dark Ages when there was very little money going around. And the Knights Templar can be credited with basically helping to bring us out of that. That they were given this charter that exempted them from the rule that existed at the time against usury, against loaning out money on interest. And so they were then able to set up banks all across Europe. They didn't call them banks, but basically, it was a series of preceptories, they called them, all along the routes to the Holy Land. And pilgrims could stop at these preceptories along the route as they were going to Jerusalem, and they could access their accounts there. They could set up an account before they started on their pilgrimage with the Templars, deposit their money with the Templars, and then the Templars would give them a chit, as they called it. It was a piece of paper with coded and ciphered information that said how much money they had deposited. And then they could go to the other preceptories along the route and show the Templars there this chit, and the Templars there could decipher it, and they could determine that, yes, this person has this amount of money on account, and so they can get just the amount of money they need for that leg of their trip. And they don't have to carry, you know, be loaded down with gold when they start off on their journey, and which is going to get stolen from them, probably.
Or make them a candidate for that. And so, but it still, again, depends on trust. You have to believe that that chit that they give you is just as good as the money you left behind or the gold you left behind.
Yeah, and, you know, they can be credited with coming up with the idea that, you know, that a piece of paper that says you have this amount of money on deposit is just as good as having the money.
And part of that came from the religious faith of the Templars, that you believed in them. They carried the cross that Columbus would later, you know, use as a flag. But that was part of it. The idea is that these were religious people, and so it was an act of faith that you could do this, and your money would be waiting for you on the other end.
Yeah. And so, you know, this is how they got rich. This is the source of the fabled Templar wealth, was just commerce through banking. They also had some other business ventures, but this is really how they got rich. And so then it's interesting that they said that the source of their wealth was this severed head that they said spoke to them, called Baphomet, and they said that this is really how they got rich. And you wonder what's the connection between those two things. And I wondered, too, and I can't say this for sure, but I'm thinking that they divined information about this idea of a banking system from the head. And I know that sounds a little crazy considering all the other things I've been talking about, but that's really the only thing I could come up with for why
they credit Baphomet with being so central to their power.
Yeah, exactly.
When you think about it, it was outside of their Christian belief system.
Definitely. Well, I think for the Templars that did participate in these rituals with Baphomet, that
No, I meant the idea of usury. I mean, the idea of loaning money, and that was outside of a Christian belief.
Yes.
And so they almost had to turn to another god or another belief system to introduce it into what they were doing.
Yeah, yes. But I also think that they may have acquired these ideas somehow from figures in the Bible that they might have. It's said that the Templars, we know that they were stationed on the Temple Mount when they first were forming, and that it's said that they were excavating beneath the Temple Mount. And, you know, a lot of people think they might have found some treasure down there, like the Ark of the Covenant or something. And I don't really know what they found, but I postulated that maybe that's where they found Baphomet. They found this head down there. And And that's how I possibly connected it to King Solomon.
And that's how you go back to Solomon. Well, any way you look at it, there is a kind of religious faith that's needed in the dollar bill in order for it to work. Still, to this day, you have to believe, you have to empower it, or it is powerless because it's just a piece of paper. So how do you do that? Well, as we're learning, it's in the color, it's in the symbols, it's in the watchwords, it's in the reaffirmation that capitalism is worth the leap of faith. It's in the use of occult meanings, like the dollar signs, like the two different versions of the dollar signs. And it continually reaffirms that this will work. If you just believe, if we all believe, we'll all get rich. We will all create something out of nothing. And we'll start there when we come back for more phone calls for Tracy Twyman. Solomon's Treasure. It's the pursuit of the magic and mystery of America's money. Next on Coast to Coast AM. Going all across the world for calls for Tracy Twyman. Solomon's Treasure will go west of the Rockies, where David is waiting on Coast to Coast AM. David, you're talking to Tracy.
Yes, sir. Pleasure. Longtime listener, second time caller.
Thank you.
And my heart goes out to Art Bell.
Of course.
Absolutely. Won't dwell on that. The original flag had 13 stars in a circle.
Mm-hmm.
Then you had Apollo 13.
That's right.
And the Mayans and Egyptians consider cats and 13 lucky?
Yeah, that's right.
Is there something to that?
Well, the number 13 and its significance in the occult, there's just many layers to that. But definitely one of the things is that the number 13 is significant to the lunar calendar. And I think that's how it ties in with the Mayans also, that there's 13 lunar months in a solar year. And actually a lunar calendar is one of the most perfect calendars you can imagine. It has 13 months in it with exactly 28 days each and, you know, divided into 4 weeks of exactly 7 days. Everything falls on the same day every year. It's a perfect calendar. And I think that definitely the number 13 has been revered by ancient cultures and occultists because it links in with the lunar calendar and the moon, which, you know, a lot of ancient cultures worshipped the moon, amongst other things.
Now, some people say that the number 13 in American myths will refer to Jesus and the 12 disciples making 13. But there's really not very many specific references to that. It's just something that I think people say. But we really don't see any evidence of that in the symbolism of the money, do we?
No, I mean, I think that's just another tangential example of the number 13 being sacred and appearing in sacred writings and myths that, yeah, there's Jesus and his 12 disciples. You can also think about the 12 tribes of Israel. And if you look at the references to the 12 tribes of Israel throughout the Old Testament, you'll find that there's actually 13 tribes. And every time they mention them, there's one tribe that they choose to omit for one reason or another. Sometimes it's the Levites, sometimes it's the Benjamites. But it's very weird. It's like when people don't want to put the 13th floor on a building.
Right.
You know, they even in the Bible, they didn't want to mention the number 13. Instead, they said 12 and 1.
Yeah, I think it's dust mites are the ones that we leave out a lot. I'm joking. East of the Rockies, Greg is on Coast to Coast AM for Tracy Twyman. Greg?
Hi, Ian. Hi, Tracy. It's nice to talk to you.
Hey.
I had two quick questions. I thought the symbol with the serpent and the staff came from the book of Numbers 21, 8, and 9. And also, have you ever looked at the old 20s? Has anyone ever pointed out that if you blow up the image in the bottom corner, there's a image of an alien gray
I think
I've actually seen it.
Take me back to that again, Greg. What are you talking about again? And
the
what?
The old 20s. Okay, the old 20s.
Right.
If you blow up the image in the bottom right, or any corner, actually, you'll find the head of a gray alien.
Wow.
Has anyone ever pointed that out? Or
I've never heard. Tracy, ever heard of that?
No, not especially. I think if you blow up the background on these bills, any of them, and look at it closely enough, you can find all sorts of stuff. But I think that's kind of like looking at clouds. Now, the other thing that you mentioned was interesting. You talked about the serpent on the staff coming from the Old Testament. And, yes, there's the scene where they're wandering through the desert
right.
with Moses, and all of a sudden they all get attacked by fiery serpents.
Right.
And they get sick. And so God tells Moses to put a serpent, or a brass serpent, he says,
yeah.
on a stick and hold it up, and everyone that looks at it will get healed. And so that has been an image that's repeatedly used in alchemical manuscripts. They show the image of the snake coiled around the Tau cross.
Right.
And it represents the same thing as the Caduceus, the transformation and healing.
Well, I mean, if you're going for transformation and serpents and staffs, you got to go back to what gave Moses the power to free the children of Israel to begin with, being, taking his rod, if you will, and turning it into a snake and then back again.
Yeah.
And that, too, that same powerful symbolism of power. Let's go international line. Jason for Tracy Twyman on Coast to Coast AM, talking about magic in our money. Jason, where are you calling from?
Montreal. Good morning, Ian. Good morning, Tracy.
Good morning.
I was just curious if you were familiar with, say, on an old 20, because that I'm certain of, but primarily on singles, some of the old singles, and maybe some of the newer bills, but certainly on the old 20s, or the regular 20s, as we would think of them, Jackson, there's a raised portion on the bill and what it can do.
Like an embossed portion?
Raised to the extent that if you rubbed your thumbnail on it, you would actually feel a bzzz, on, off, in a very small way. And there's something you can do, like almost like on a bar bet kind of thing, that people would say, oh, no way. I'll tell you what it is. It's kind of funny because I've done it repeatedly, and it always works. So if you have a fairly new bill, and if you look at the Jackson, I'm just using the Jackson because that's what I've used primarily.
Okay.
And you use a new bill, let's say a Jackson 20, and at the point where the lapel is on his jacket, even if you have one in your pocket, you might notice it. If you scrape your nail across the lapel of his jacket up and down for the most part, you'll feel a little raised bump on, off, about, like a millionth of an inch for each bump. And that's just the lapel, the grating on his lapel of the jacket. Now, the thing that makes that most unusual, at least to me, is that you can, how you can't strike a regular match on anything but flint, mm-hmm. assumably?
Okay.
On his jacket, and I've done it 100 times, you'll do it and you'll find out you can't, you can actually strike a match on his jacket, a regular match out of a dry one, a good regular match out of a matchbook, and you'll actually get the match to light if you strike it right across the lapel.
All right, well, I have to give that a try sometime. I'll grab a Big Andy, as I call him, the new 20s, and I'll give that a shot. Bob, first-time caller line for Tracy Twyman on Coast to Coast AM. Bob?
Hi, thanks for taking my call tonight.
Sure.
Hey, with the Templars worshiping Baphomet, Baphomet is actually the Christian demonization of the old Celtic horned god.
Well, I think... Tracy, go ahead. I think Tracy actually talks about it. It has more origin, perhaps, than just one.
No, I'm not saying you're wrong totally, but I definitely think that the imagery of Baphomet connects with that. For the listeners, there was, in addition to the image of the severed head, the Templars also had images of Baphomet shown as a goat-headed deity, half human, with a goat head, and then with both male and female sexual organs. And yeah, the goat-headed creature is very similar to the horned god that you're talking about. I think his name is Cerinus or something.
The horned god in Celtic mythology is a symbol of fertility.
Yes, yes.
But when the Knights Templar advanced, so to speak, in their understanding of spirituality,
mm-hmm.
put it in this context because it's a lot easier, the reason that both images of male and female genitalia came up was the divine male, divine female.
Mm-hmm.
Also, if you look at the reliefs on the Gulderstrup cauldron, you will notice an image of the horn god, which was the Celtic fertility symbol,
mm-hmm.
holding a torque in one hand and a snake in the other. The torque representing divinity, the snake representing the power of change and transformation,
mm-hmm.
of shedding the old skin and donning the new skin. It's not about external transfiguration or alchemy. It's about internal transfiguration.
Well, I think you're partially right there, but
that's the true symbol of Baphomet in relationship with the Templars, because the Templars used many different religious symbols.
Well, but hold on. I don't know that that's true exclusive to all other claims. For example, I saw somewhere that said that Baphomet, the word Baphomet, is really just a corruption of the word Muhammad, and that this represents a time when the Templars became very intertwined with the assassins of Muslim mysticism. Have you ever heard that before, Tracy?
Yeah, I have. And, you know, I'm still holding that out as a possible connection. I haven't been able to, you know, verify that. And it's hard to assimilate that with the rest of the symbolism. I mean, really, the Templars don't seem any more Orthodox Muslim than they do Orthodox Christian. So I think that the other explanations of Baphomet are stronger.
Well, you know, we had an author on many years ago. This goes back to like the year 2000 or something. So I'm kind of pulling this out of thin air for me, a little magic act. But that book was called The Templars and the Assassins.
Mm-hmm.
And he talked about how at the beginning, the Templars and the Assassins were sort of like sworn enemies. But at some point, they actually begin to reach out to each other, and the Assassins kind of mirror what the Templars are doing in Islam. They were doing what the Templars are doing in Christendom, and that they begin to have, you can see that that's where, you know, a lot of Arabic words that we use today commonly came through the Knights Templar and became into our culture through this association with Islam. I don't know that that's true, but I think it's interesting to contemplate anyway. And what about the images of Baphomet in American iconography too? Like, don't you have references to statues where George Washington is in sort of a Baphomet pose?
Oh yeah, yeah. Well, the classic image of the goat-headed Baphomet is of him seated with his one hand pointing up to the heavens and the other pointing down to the nether regions of hell, and you know, representing this sort of unity of opposites. And there's a statue of George Washington that's kind of hidden now. It was so weird that people actually made them move it from its original space. But it shows him in exactly that same pose. It's based on a statue of Zeus that's very similar. But and so George Washington in the statue very much looks like a god ruling over the universe, but he's making this Baphometic pose. And so it's really quite striking.
But of all the god images, again, it's so intriguing that for all of the shared Christian background of so many of the founding fathers, there's so little Christian imagery that gets, you know, translated into the new American iconography. And instead, they go to images like Baphomet, the Greeks, the Roman gods, Celtic gods, and the images that are on our money. And we'll talk about more about the magic. Take your calls next on Coast to Coast. Let's get the two that have been hanging on the longest up right away, and then we'll just leave everybody else for the rest of this half hour trying to get through to Tracy Twyman and the book Solomon's Treasure. Will go to the wild card line where Joel is waiting for Tracy on Coast to Coast AM. Joel?
Hi. Great show.
Thank you.
Got a couple questions. What do you think about the value of the dollar falling every year. If they apply a value to paper when they print it, how come we're losing money every year as it goes by? And where do you see the dollar and our monetary system going from here? And the other question is, what do you think about the Middle Eastern countries wanting to trade oil for the gold dinar? And they want the international community to do that.
Well, I can't really comment on the second question too much. I'm not familiar with what you're talking about there. However, the first part is about, why can't the Federal Reserve just declare the dollar to be more valuable than it is? And there's several things going on. One thing, as I was explaining, all currencies are valued in relation to each other now because there is no gold standard. And so, you know, if the pound, for instance, is becoming more valuable, then that makes ours necessarily less valuable because it's in relation to the pound. Now, the Federal Reserve can manipulate the value of money in such that they can choose to create more or less money, and through the market forces, because of you know, creating more money creates inflation and things like that. That's how they can control the value of money somewhat, but you know that's not the only thing working on the value of money. So they're able to control it when they put it out there, but once it's out there,
market forces
are at work. Yes,
you had the invisible hand, going back to Adam Smith, who understood even in 1776 the magic of paper money and of capitalism. He got it.
Yeah.
He saw that you were creating something out of nothing. And although he doesn't address it as a kind of alchemy, he clearly understands it as that.
Yeah, I think the idea of the invisible hand, you know, yeah, no one thought about it at the time that he wrote that book. But it is the idea of, you know, almost the hand of God, or definitely, you know, a supernatural process at work there.
Right. But I'll touch on two things. I wonder whether if money is devalued, or there was something that happened to our U.S. currency beyond the day-to-day, you know, trading on American currency, I wonder whether they might change the magical symbols, if you will, or whether the bill might go through a kind of transformation to try to reaffirm its value through symbolism and watchwords.
Yeah, I've been wondering that myself. You notice that all the other bills have changed, but they keep the $1 bill the same. And they've changed the other bills because they're trying to prevent counterfeiting. But the fact is that it's not worth it for anyone to counterfeit the dollar bill. So that's the excuse for why they never change it. But I think it's because it's, you know, this perfect
collection of symbols.
Symbolism that, you know, they would never want to change. But, yeah, I wonder what the future holds, especially if they're talking about having a cashless society and having all electronic money. You know, that has no symbolic significance to it.
But talk about a leap of faith. I mean, the idea of electronic money, where you don't even have a symbol in your hand that represents what you own, then you just have to kind of take somebody's word for it. I mean, that's a true investment into a belief system.
Yeah, I think if they try to go to a cashless society, they're going to find that people have less confidence in the money, and it's going to affect the value of the money, and it's going to affect the economy. So I hope they never do that.
I don't know.
I like using cash.
I do too, but you know what? I go back to an experience I can remember having consciously. The very first time that I used an ATM, you know, back in the 80s, I was really suspicious about putting a deposit in an ATM. Right. I mean, I had my check. I was going to put it in there. The bank said I could do this. I had a hard time putting it into a faceless machine. Given enough time and enough, you know, turns at the ATM, later on, I became suspicious of handing my money over to a person. I become totally acclimated to the machine. The machine was my friend. And I don't know about this person on the other end. I mean, yeah. I had a paradigm shift. I think his point about the oil and the gold is something to consider too, because what a threat would it be to the U.S. economy and to other paper-based economies where money is a kind of magic, that if somebody actually had to trade a real product for a real product, so gold for oil, wow, what would that mean to the value of money if we had to start doing that? But let's get Craig on for the wild card line on Coast to Coast AM. Craig?
Yeah, on the dollar bill, have you seen the owl and what I call the winged demons?
I've seen the purported owl. Yes, it's one of those things that's kind of hidden in the background if you blow it up really big.
In background of the spider webbing?
Yeah, yeah.
Where do you see it? Just so people can go look for it, Craig.
Go ahead, Craig.
On the front of the dollar bill, in the four corners, are the one symbol. Three of them are ovals, and the one up in the right hand corner is kind of a shield, if you will, an odd design.
Right.
In the upper left hand corner of that shield, there's a concave part of the shield edge.
Right.
And right sitting right on that concave is the owl.
Okay. All right. Cool. I'll have to look for that. I'm sitting in a totally dark studio, so I can't see it, but I can see the dollar bill enough to look for that corner, and I'll go back to it. And then what was the winged demon?
Bottom edge on the front. There's all the spider webbing.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And about a quarter of the way in from the left and a quarter of the way in from the right, there's a separate symbol that's outlined in black. That symbol to me is a standing winged demon.
Baphomet?
Don't know who it is. You get the shape of a body standing up with what would be arms, except their wings coming down. Now that may be a stretch of my imagination, but they are set off from the rest.
Well, I see what you're talking about. I don't know if I agree that that's a winged demon underneath it, but you know, people should note this. It's got to mean something. I haven't figured out what it means yet, but there are. If you look at the dollar bill on the front, and then look at the bottom. Right, on the same line where it says $1 at the bottom, looking
right
to the left and to the right of that, you'll see that there are these two, like, black bumps, I guess, little hills that kind of come up from the bottom, and I don't know what they mean. I think it looks like they're trying to mark off geometry there, you know, but I'm not sure what it means. It's very unusual, though.
Do the engravers spend a lot of time explaining why they're engraving what they engrave? I mean, do we have a record of the engravers and or their Masonic connection and or an explanation for why they chose what they chose?
There is a lot of records about the designing of the dollar bill. And I was telling you about how President Roosevelt was the one who decided to switch the orders of the front and back of the Great Seal of the United States. He decided to put them in reverse order on the back of the dollar bill. And there's actually a sketch that he made that he gave to the engravers, and he said, take these and switch them around. And he drew it, and it's reproduced in one of the books that I have. It's really interesting. You can actually see President Roosevelt's handwriting and little sketch drawings where he, you know, assisted in the designing of this dollar bill. And yeah, there's a little bit of stuff that they wrote about what it means. And you know, I've told you a lot of what they
right
said. But
do they cop to the engravers or to the designers? Do they cop to a lot of the Masonic symbolism? Do they explain why this as opposed to that?
No. If you go to the Treasury Department's website, they have articles that are dismissing the idea that there's anything Masonic about the dollar.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and I don't believe them.
And we'll leave it there. We'll come back. We'll wrap up the rest of our phone calls. Lots of people waiting to get through to Tracy Twyman next on Coast to Coast AM. Talking with Tracy Twyman about the magic of money and all of the magical symbols that are on money and the belief that we have to have that this is valuable, an almost kind of an alchemy in order for it to work. And West of the Rockies on Coast to Coast AM. Ann?
Hi, Ann.
Hi, you're talking with Tracy.
Hi, Tracy.
Hello.
Oh, it's fascinating. And I use the word intentionally. To answer that caller's about China, China's dumping the dollar and pegging their yuan to a mixed basket of currency. And Iran is in March going off the dollar. So this is my question. Oh, and by the way, Big Andy has an RFID in its right eye, and if you put it in the microwave, it'll explode.
Get out.
You know, I've seen it on conspiracyplanet.com.
Oh, really? No, honestly, I can take a Big Andy and I can put it in a microwave,
uh-huh,
And how long will it take for that?
3 seconds.
And the RFID in the eye will explode.
We'll go boom. Yeah.
Okay, I gotta go to an all-night convenience store and get one. Thank you for that.
And I guess that's for tracking money. And if you wrap it in aluminum foil, the monitors won't go off.
Wow.
So read that on. But here's my question: what is going to happen? And I have a feeling what's going to happen. That's going to be war in Iran. But what will happen when the spell, the magician's spell, is broken? See, other countries are starting to wake up to the American dollar being empty.
Well, it's not empty. It's our faith gives us its value, and it's real. You know, what we invest the faith in it, and it is real. Now, if you're talking about people losing their faith in the dollar, then yeah, it tanks. Then it becomes a piece of paper.
It's a spell. And the South American countries are paying off the IMF, and they're going for their own resources, and they're thriving. So, and Asia and the Middle Eastern countries, they're waking up to the spell. You know what I mean? The spell is broken.
Right. It does have that feel to it in some respects, that it's kind of, and Tracy writes about this in the book, that there's this, you have to all agree that it's valuable in order for it to have a kind of Ponzi-like, you know, ability to multiply. And if you don't, then what happens? And we can only assume that somehow we would be able to regroup and come up with something else. But it's terrifying to think of the transition ahead if we had to do that, because I think we all like it the way it is. It largely benefits us. Let's go to Storm, east of the Rockies on Coast to Coast AM. Storm?
Hi.
How are you talking with Tracy?
First of all, I wanted to mention that guy talking about the owl.
Mm-hmm.
I always understood that that was the spider that wove the web.
There at the corner in the upper right-hand corner?
It looks like a spider.
Okay, cool. Well, the front doesn't look as much like a spider web as the back does.
Right.
The front looks a lot more like lattice work or caning or something, but then the back looks very much more like a spider web. But an interesting point. Thank you.
The question that I had, though, I noticed that, you know, like institutions store money flat. Our wallets are designed to fold. And I noticed that when you fold the money in half, the seals line up completely, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, does that, like, activate the magic?
You know, yeah, that's interesting. I spent, when I was obsessing on the dollar, I spent a long time folding it up in various ways and trying to come up with something doing that. And I didn't come up with anything in particular, but it's amazing how symmetrical it is. And also, yeah, when you fold it and you look at which elements are lined up by doing that, I mean, it's definitely intentional. And it's interesting that, again, none of the other bills have this. In fact, they've all been changed so that everything's kind of off-center. But they don't want to do that with the $1 bill, because if you change the way everything is arranged geometrically, then that would change the meaning of it. So I think you're right that, yeah, when you fold it up and kind of look at the light and see which elements are lining up when you do that, it's very interesting.
Thank you, Storm. I appreciate that. And going back to Anne's comment, too, and the belief in it, and what you said, Tracy, I'm just reminded of the significance of the Eucharist in the transformation of just bread and wine into sacramental elements,
mm-hmm.
and that everybody around the table agrees to that, that it, everybody believes in that. And if you take away that belief, then it just becomes just, you know, bread and wine. But that's the power comes from the belief,
mm-hmm.
in that transformation. And what will happen if somebody at, you know, like an Iran or a China or somebody else starts constantly saying this has no value, and they keep pointing the finger at the currency, what's going to happen? I mean, I what are the possibilities of that? It's kind of staggering, a little scary. Let's go first time caller line, Rick, on Coast to Coast AM for Tracy Twyman. Rick?
Yes, thank you for receiving my call. On the back of the dollar bill, there are the 13 stars and 13 arrows and 13 fig leaves.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
13 stripes on the breastplate.
Mm-hmm.
And over on to the pyramid, there's 13 layers.
Mm-hmm. Right, we talked about that a little bit earlier.
And the cornerstone, which the builders rejected, which is the CNI there. And also, if you notice the Star David with the 13 stars. Now, the Star David is actually two of the pyramids, one inverted and the other, and leaving the corner.
Yeah, have you heard about the trick where if you draw a Star of David on the backside of the Great Seal, which is the part with the pyramid on it, if you draw a Seal of Solomon there, a six-pointed star, in such a way as to where the points match up with the N in Novus and the O, the last O in Ordo, and the final M in Seclorum.
And oh, okay.
And the M, O, and then, okay, the A in Annuit, the first one, and then the S at the end of Coeptus. And then if you put, okay, the other end of the six-pointed star right up there at the top where the top of the pyramid is pointing, you draw a six-pointed star with all of those elements, and it spells out Mason.
Wow, okay.
Do you catch that?
The Masons did put that on there.
Star of David inside that seal, and the points of the Star of David point to the words Mason. Point to the word Mason. And thank you for that. And they don't even admit that in the Treasury Department. They'll say that's another coincidence.
No. The only thing they admitted to that was mystical at all was they admitted that they made the money green to make people think about fertility.
Wildcard line, David on Coast to Coast AM for Tracy Twyman. David?
Hey, how you doing there, Ian?
Good. What do you think of this?
Well, pretty good. It's a pretty good show. Tracy, I have a couple questions for you.
Mm-hmm.
The first one is, what happened to the Baphomet, the talking skull? Whatever happened to that, is there a legend or anything behind that? And then I was wondering about the author of The Legend of Sleepy Hollow. I think his name was Washington Irving.
Right.
And, was he a Mason? Because he has the Headless Horseman. And here's poor Ichabod, and he's after the wealth of this farmer's daughter, and he's undone by a Headless Horseman. Hmm. So I don't know. I just wondering. So if I'll take my answers off air, okay?
Okay, yeah. I don't know if the author of Sleepy Hollow is a Mason or not, but those are some interesting symbolic elements that you pointed out.
What happened to Baphomet?
Oh, yeah, the Baphomet question. Thanks. Yeah, no one really knows, but I did have this theory that it might have been picked up by Constantine when his mother, Helena, was exploring the Holy Land, and she was finding all sorts of holy relics and erecting churches to them and stuff. I thought that maybe she found Baphomet, because what happened with Constantine, he decided, for one thing, he and his kingdom were very wealthy, and he decided to move the capital of the empire to Constantinople, and basically creating the seeds of a new empire in the east, and all the wealth in the Roman Empire flowed over to the new Byzantine Empire, and they were the only they basically were controlling trade in the world from that point on until for another few hundred years. And it seems like, you know, the wealth of Rome sort of switched over to Byzantium, and in Constantinople, Constantine.
Running out of time here, Tracy.
Okay.
No, I just had to say, just running out of time, because I'll just refer people then to the book. I'd like to think that he, watches over our undertakings, is God doing it, but maybe it is Baphomet, and whatever it is, it's worthy of taking a look at Solomon's treasure. Thanks again, Tracy. Look forward to talking to you again real soon.
All right.
Deus Tiamat, and I do too.